Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our second series on Vietnam, on the war in Vietnam, and on with Vietnam vets. We got so much positive feedback on our first series, we decided to run a second group. And so, again, we looked for vets that had been in Vietnam. We've got men, we've got women, we've got even have a person who was in the Vietnamese Army, of course, on the American side, was as a scout. And today we have the pleasure of interviewing and talking to Marvin Wolf. And Marvin is... was in the service. He was a photojournalist. Plus, he can tell us all the other hundreds of jobs that he had when he was in Vietnam and before. And Marvin has also written a few books, some in Vietnam and different kinds. Marvin, do you want to tell us kind of what your background is now with doing those books?
Well, I've written 22 books, including 4 that I ghost wrote, so my name is not on them. I just took the money.
Yeah, that's good.
5 of my books have been about true crime. That was what I did early on. My first book, which came about by accident, was about Japan and how its corporate masters, I'll call them that way. In Japan, they call them Shinko Zaibatsu. Shinko means new. Zaibatsu is a kind of I forgot the word in English.
Okay.
It's monopoly. That's what it is.
Uh-huh.
And they got together with the Japanese government right after World War II, and as soon as the occupation ended in 1955, they began to rebuild their industry, and their goal, their eventual goal, was to lead the world in manufacturing and exports. They have to export. They're an export nation. In order to do that, they cut more than a few corners. In order to do that, they broke their own laws, they broke international laws, industrial espionage, dumping, all sorts of crimes. And my book was the first to put this together and expose it. It was called The Japanese Conspiracy, and it's out of print. You can't buy a new copy. You might be able to find a used one somewhere.
Maybe find something on eBay or something like that.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
There weren't that many copies printed, so there aren't that many copies around.
Uh-huh.
But that got me into the book business. Before that, I had been a photojournalist, sort of a globe-trotting guy. Not unusual for me to get a call at 6 o'clock in the morning in California, where I lived, from some editor in New York or Washington, asking if I could go to Seattle that day or Hawaii the next day or whatever. And then when I was when my daughter was 13, I got sole custody of her, and she came to live with me. And suddenly I was a single parent.
Wow.
Well, you can't be a single parent and a globetrotter.
Yeah, at the same time. Yeah, that's
not at the same time, exactly.
Now, you learned or you at least honed your skills in photojournalism in when you were in Vietnam. And what years? Yep. What years were those?
I arrived in August 1965, and I went home in November of 1966.
Okay, and here's one of the questions, Marvin, that I always I've asked each one of my the people that I've interviewed, and that is, when you did you go to Vietnam by like one of the commercial airlines, or did you? I mean, and the question that I have is, what was your first impression of Vietnam when you hit the ground, and was where was that?
Well, that's two questions.
Well, okay. Then
the first question is, I did not go on a commercial airline. I flew in a C-130.
Okay.
With about 20 guys. Down the middle of the aircraft were two Jeeps with their trailers.
Right.
One Jeep had a recoilless rifle, and the other one had radios, lots and lots of radios. And then every spare piece of room was pallets. Mm-hmm. Sea rations, ammunition, medical supplies, and that sort of thing.
One of our friends that we interviewed, my neighbor, flew C-130s, and he said that was the most, one of the most versatile planes around in Vietnam, because they could convert it almost from carrying supplies, and it could carry a lot, to being converted to a medevac. So,
could do much more than that. Yes,
yeah.
It was a very versatile aircraft, Air Force aircraft, which first came into service, I think, about 1961. Now, the C-130s that we flew across the Pacific with was specifically configured for long distances. They had big fuel tanks, big propellers, kind of propellers that they could cruise at a high altitude, a relatively high altitude for a prop plane. And we flew from Warner Robins Air Force Base, which is near Macon, Georgia, to an Air Force Base near San Francisco, which is now closed, and then from there to Hickam Field, or Hickam Air Force Base, which shares runways with Honolulu International Airport.
Right.
And then to Wake Island, which is not an island at all. It's in an atoll. And the atoll is filled at that time with shot down airplanes.
That's
and,
right.
And then from there, we were supposed to go to Okinawa. But 800 miles before we got to Okinawa, we lost an engine. It caught fire, and they had to shut it down. So we made an emergency landing on Iwo Jima.
Wow.
The reason that there was an airfield there was because that was the reason why our Marines took it. That's why 7,000 Marines gave their lives in 1945, to take that as an emergency airfield for B-29s coming back from bombing Japan.
Wow.
But it was still there in 1965. 20 years after the war, and it was there strictly for that purpose, in case somebody needed a place to land.
Yeah.
We arrived there in the middle of the night. There were no buses or anything else. The senior officer on our aircraft told us to take our valuables, leave our weapons. No, we took our weapons. Took our weapons and our headgear, and we jumped down from the plane, and we walked about a mile down a white strip to a dim light. And the dim light turned to be happened to be over a sign that said, "Welcome to Iwo Jima International Airport. elevation plus one dry season, minus two wet season."
I like that. Yeah.
We woke somebody up, the duty officer, I guess, and pretty soon the airmen were pouring from their bunks, and they all had one question: "Do you have any women on the plane?" We did not.
Uh-huh.
They were nevertheless very glad to see us, because it's pretty boring over there. They had nothing to do except wait for a plane that needed their help. They played a lot of volleyball. They had dug a swimming pool, well, probably blasted a swimming pool out of the coral, and the sea, the tide filled it twice a day. And the first guy that got into the pool had to throw out any of the little sharks that came in.
Oh, my gosh.
These were little ones, three-footers.
Oh, three-footers, good. Yeah, that would make me feel a lot better. my brother-in-law was stationed on Okinawa during, when he was in Vietnam. Well, he wasn't in Vietnam, but he served as a kind of communications person. Now, when you hit the ground in Vietnam, what was your first impression?
Hot, humid, and it stunk to high heaven because the only place they could put us, well, we reconfigured to go on an air assault, was in the Nha Trang garbage dump.
Oh, gosh. You know, Marvin, I don't think you would be surprised. Rick here is my producer with me. I think that every single vet that we've asked that question has said something to that effect. Hot, humid, dusty. You could almost chew the air. And the last one, it either stunk from garbage or it stunk from diesel fuel or something like that. And then where did they send you after you got to out on the ground in Vietnam?
Well, we were going to be there for 24 hours, and the airplanes that we had come over on left. I don't know where they went. And they flew more different airplanes in with different propellers and different engines, all C-130s, which were configured for short takeoff and landings. And into that 24 hours that we were there, the sole purpose of stopping there was so that we could reconfigure into aircraft that we could land on 900 feet of packed red clay that had been left by the French in 1954. That was where we were going. The best thing we did that day was we took a swim in the ocean in our skivvies. Nha Trang is right on the ocean. They put us in the garbage dump just south of the city. There were tents put up. Somebody had come and put up tents where we could sleep for the night, and they put up two freshwater showers so we could shower after we came out of the ocean. I'd had a bath in Okinawa. We actually did get to Okinawa, but in any kind of I'll call it a convoy, whether it's an aerial convoy or a ground vehicle convoy, if you have to drop out of the line, and there were 50 C-130s flying across the Pacific about 30 miles apart. Now, 30 miles doesn't take very long in a C-130. You know, it's about 15 minutes maybe. So when we dropped out of line, we had to go to the end of the line, and then finally we got to Okinawa, and then we had to wait to go on, because we had to wait for all the other airplanes to take off, so we would be the last ones, because we had dropped out. So the guy that I was one of the two guys I was traveling with, I mean, there were 20 guys on the airplane, but I only knew two of them. One of them was my boss, and the other was my colleague, Joe Treister, who was a reporter. I was a photographer. And Charles Seiler, then a major, was the public information officer of the 1st Cavalry Division. And he had been to Japan a couple of times. He knew where to go and what to do. He took us to a place where you got a steam bath, which included a real bath. They showered us. They put us in a hot tub, basically. And then we got massages. We had middle-aged women walking on our back. And then we had some really good food, and then we got back on the airplane and went into Vietnam. And then we did get to swim in the ocean, which was kind of nice.
That's cool.
And then about 8 o'clock that night, they had a briefing for all the commanders. This is the advance party of the 1st Cavalry Division. The 1st Cavalry Division, with its reinforcing units, was about 17 or 18,000 men. The advance party was 1,030. And our job, like any advance party anywhere, was to prepare the ground for the arrival of the main body. But because we were the world's first air cavalry division, we had not only all those troops, we had 437 helicopters, and we had to find a place to park them where, number one, they wouldn't be sitting next to each other. If you blew one up, you blew them all up.
Right, yeah. We've heard that quite a bit, that they kind of separated them so that, you know.
Dispersed,
like,
is the word.
Right.
They had to disperse them.
Yes.
They wanted at least 30 feet between helicopters, and we were able to do that. So that night before we flew there, there was a briefing for all the commanders, because I was public information. Me and Trista went to that briefing, and afterwards they issued ammunition. They issued us 200 rounds of 5.56 caliber ammunition for our M16 rifles. We all carried our rifles, but we didn't get the ammunition until we got there. So we spent the next hour or two taking the cartridges out of these boxes and putting them into magazines. The next morning, we took off about 7 in the morning. I was in the second airplane, and they, as I said, they reconfigured everything. I found myself sitting between the assistant division commander, a brigadier general named John M. Wright, Jr., and the division command sergeant major. His name was Chester Westervelt. I sat down, and they sat down on either side of me, and I was not happy with that. There was only room on the airstrip for one airplane. There was no place to turn around. There was no shoulder. The jungle came right up to the edge of the airfield. And in fact, there were some places that had started to take over the airfield, but there were no big trees. It was just brush. Which meant that the plane had to land, it had to disgorge its troops, and then it had to turn around. And you think of a limousine in an alley, back and fill. Then
right.
You taxi all the way back to the other end of the airfield and do the same thing again, so it could take off into the wind. Meanwhile, we are circling out of what we hope was small arms range, right above the mountains. This is a valley in the mountains of a place called Anke, A-N-K-H-E. There was nothing at Anke. There was a few villages around, but not much other than that. However, it was near Highway 19, which bisects the country. It goes from the mountains out to the sea. And that was one reason we were there. The other reason we were there was we had a pretty good-sized valley with a lot of grass. By the time we were ready to get into our final landing configuration, we had bounced around in that rough air for about 20 minutes. I had taken 2 salt tablets. I was supposed to take one, but I took 2. I should have saved one. Anyway, I had to vomit. I was not going to vomit and put one drop of anything on those guys, the sergeant major or the general. I would rather be shot than do that. So at the last minute, when I couldn't stand anymore, I had a brainwave. I pulled my steel helmet off and left the liner, which is made out of something called duck. It's a kind of plastic. I pulled the helmet off. I emptied my stomach in the helmet. And as though they had rehearsed it, the general on one side and the sergeant major on the other side reached over and patted me on the back. Good thinking, they said. They did not want to be vomited either.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's, and I do understand what you mean about the salt tablets, because I worked up in the hills logging, and of course they would not let us drink water unless we had salt tablets, because You didn't pee. You just sweated everything out. So that was kind of the way it was. So then when you, I was going to say, you know, you, as a photojournalist, and you know, and you were doing photography too, correct?
Well, for the first 4 months, all I did was photography.
Mm-hmm.
I went with, I had a pretty good high school education, and I knew how to type, but I had talked my way into that section. I had literally talked my way into the section because I was a photojournalist. I really wasn't a photojournalist. I was a photographer. I could get properly exposed film. Without there were no fancy cameras or light meters in those days. You had to know what you were doing, and that much I did know. And I believed in myself, and I believed that if I had an opportunity to take pictures of men in the field, men in combat, I would come back with good pictures, and I did. So after 4 months, my boss, Major Seiler, took me into his little tiny tent where he slept, and he said, "It's time for you to learn how to be to write news copy." That's all he said. It wasn't a suggestion. So when your boss says that, you say yes, sir, and you move on. And I got Joe Treister, who had been a pretty good reporter for the Miami Herald, to give me about half an hour class on how you organize a news story. And that was the start of my career in journalism. For the next couple of months, Treister edited my copy. Hang on a second. And have a little sip of water.
Yeah, there you go. That water always helped. And you know, something I want to also let you know, Marvin. Would it be okay, you know, since we're doing the half-hour interviews here, and you are giving me so much good information.
You want me to skip something?
Well, no, I'm not saying not to skip anything, but I'm wondering if we can bring you back maybe next week or something for another half hour interview. We'll get instead of doing a half hour with you, we'll do a whole hour dance with you and divide you into two parts. Is that okay?
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay, and because I'm just really curious. What were the when you were doing photography and those kinds of things, were there things that you saw that you just never expected to see?
I never expected to see dead people, but the worst thing I ever saw, absolutely the worst, and still get nightmares over it, I went with an ambush patrol one night, and it was a dry hole. They didn't show up. The people we were there to kill didn't show. And we came down, just at daybreak, came down a ridge in the mountains, and we came into the outskirts, I'll say, of a little Montagnard village. The Montagnards were primitive people, the original, the aboriginal people, who lived in little villages up in the mountains, and every 7 years they would move. They'd burn their village and build a new one in a new location. Anyway, the first thing that surprised us, we didn't hear any dogs barking. We came into this village, and right in the middle of the town, we found the whole village. They were all dead, every last one of them. And their bodies were all mottled purple and black. They died of the plague, bubonic plague.
Really?
Yeah, and they were covered with fleas and covered with rats that were eating. There were dead dogs there, too. They were all dead. Everybody was dead.
And so this was like an entire village, then?
I think it was about 200 people, I would guess. I'm guessing.
Wow.
We had all been inoculated against bubonic plague before we left. That my skin crawled. This is just the worst thing I never expected to see.
And how old were you at that? You were, what, 22 at that time? Or
no, I was either 20, let's see. I think I had, I was just turned 25, I think.
You know, and that's one of the things that, you know, my friends that were in Vietnam were pretty much out of high school, 18, 19, 20, when they were there. And I think that that was, many of their stories were things that they had never expected to see or, you know, never saw again, thank God, in their lives. You know, it was just a shocker. And like you said, it's still a nightmare to you. And so...
I enlisted in the Army when I was 17.
Uh-huh.
I spent 3 years in the infantry. The last year was as an instructor. First, I was an instructor at Fort Benning in the Ranger Combat Conditioning Committee. Our committee taught officer candidates, officer basic, infantry officer basic, and officer career. So officer candidates, lieutenants, and captains. We taught methods of instruction for PT and bayonet fighting, and we taught hand-to-hand combat.
Did that really occur a lot? A lot of hand-to-hand combat? I mean...
I'm sorry?
Did that occur a lot in Vietnam? Hand-to-hand?
No.
That's what I was thinking. Probably.
No, not very much.
Right.
Well, and then near the end of that, the Russians started building a wall across Berlin, the Berlin crisis. Everybody's enlistment was extended, and I found myself at the age of 20, and I at that time was about 5'2 and a half, a drill sergeant in a basic training company at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. I was not prepared for that, but I made myself prepared.
Yeah, I saw the pictures, and we'll probably use some of the pictures for promo when we're doing this, but I did notice you, so you were 5'2".
Well, I was still growing. I grew until I was almost 26.
Oh, well, that's good.
I topped out at 5'4".
Oh, wow, you really shot up then.
Oh, yeah, I really shot up. When I joined the Army, I was 17 and exactly 5 feet tall. I came back from Korea 5'1 and a half, and I grew about another inch by the time I became a DI.
And then we get to be old like you and I are. I'm 73, and
I'm 80,
and we start shrinking now. So,
well, the good news is the taller you are, the more you shrink.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Because you're losing some of the cartilage between your, I forgot what they're called.
Well,
things in your backbone.
Yeah, the cartilage things.
I have shrunk about a half an inch, but because I was not very tall to begin with, it didn't really seem to matter much. A guy I served in Vietnam with, who was 6'2", bought a house. This is not by accident. Bought a house near mine. Lives here. He was 6'2", and now he's just 6 feet even.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit. You know, because one of the we've got a few minutes here. One of the big things that has occurred in almost every vet that I've talked to has been the issue of Agent Orange, and which was phrased pretty much all over the place. Were it sounds like here in your responses that you were exposed to Agent Orange too.
Yes, I was. I hardly know anybody who wasn't. I told you earlier that our job was to clear jungle so that we could find a place to disperse our 437 aircraft. And that jungle had been sprayed before we got there and was sprayed again while we were there. But it was sprayed at night, so I didn't know that. Everybody in our section got prostate cancer except the major. He was out there with us, so I guess he just got lucky.
Yeah.
Anyway, it all manifested differently in each of us. One guy was third stage, and he had pretty good insurance. So he went down to Loma Linda University in Southern California, I think that's Riverside,
right,
and had proton beam therapy, but his cancer came back about 15 years later. One guy had third stage, and he just said, nope, I want it out of me, and he had his prostate removed surgically and then had the rest of the treatment, radiation and then chemo.
Another thing that I was going to say, a lot of people also, I just had a friend that died last week who had lymphoma, and that was another one that was pretty. Well, why don't we stop here? We've just got a minute on this half hour here, and I will send you an email, and we will connect and schedule another time to do an additional half an hour. I know people really want to listen to you, and I've kind of been fascinated just listening to you myself, and I've heard a lot of some of these. Every story is so unique. Every story is so unique.
Yes.
And I think yours particularly, with the types of things that you did, is even falls into that category very much. So we're going to go ahead and talk again. And Marvin, you have been wonderful. And let's talk about one of your books again the next time. And I will call you and we'll let you know when the next time we interview is.
Okay. Thank you very much.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.